Today is one of the gospel passages that I hope will be shocking to you. I hope by the end of the sermon you'll find it comforting, but I hope you'll be shocked before you're comforted. It's so easy to hear these passages again and again and not really hear them. Hear the words and think we know what that means, but to not really listen. But I hope the passage today is one of the passages that shocks you. And from the very beginning of this passage, we have the idea of Jesus thanking the Father for hiding the truth from people, for hiding revelation from people, for not revealing him and his teaching to people. That should immediately shock us. Jesus Christ, who came to preach the gospel, who came to share his kingdom, who came to share the truth about himself and invite people into an everlasting relationship with himself, who came to save, says, "I thank the Father that many people don't know who I am and don't understand what I'm saying. I thank the Father that he is not sharing me with everyone." That's strange. That should shock us. It'd be a little like if we put a sign out in front of the church that said, "Please don't come in. We don't want you to know what we're doing." Or we put, you know, Christmas announcements and Easter announcements in the paper, but we said, "We'd rather you don't come. We don't want to share the gospel with you." Wouldn't that be strange? So what in the world is going on with that? Why would Jesus say that? And he's specific. He says, "I thank you that you hid from the wise and the understanding and instead revealed yourself to little children." Does that mean God hates wisdom? That he hates understanding? It's definitely not that, because we're told in other places in Scripture that we are commanded as Christians to become wise. If any of you are not wise, pray to the Father who gives all wisdom and become wise. Ask for it as a gift. And all throughout the wisdom literature, particularly the book of Proverbs, we are given guidance for how to become wise. For example, there's one proverb that says, "I walked by the house of the sloth," the lazy person, "and I looked at how it was falling down and ugly, and I stopped and I thought about it and reflected and thought, what can I learn from that? And I realized that with a little folding of the hands, or we might say a little twiddling of the thumbs, a little sitting back and being lazy, that everything falls apart and you end up in poverty." The idea in the book of Proverbs is that you're actually supposed to look at the world around you, look at people's lives around you, learn from what you see and reflecting on it, taking lessons, learn from the wisdom of other people, receive wisdom anywhere you can get it, but become wise. We're commanded both to ask for wisdom from God and to seek wisdom by learning. And as Christians, we're actually people of a book. God gave his revelation to us in a book, which means you can decide that in school you didn't like reading. I hope you do. I hope you enjoy reading. We love reading. But even if you didn't enjoy it in school, even if you don't think of yourself as a smart person or you don't think of yourself as a student, God gave you a book. So you've got to learn to study that book. You've got to learn to read the Bible. Start small if you need to. Read a couple verses a day. But you've got to read that book. And as you study it, I think you'll find yourself being drawn to read other things. Not because everybody has to enjoy reading as their favorite hobby, but because you're going to want to learn more about him, and so you're going to find other books that help you study the Bible more or help you apply it to your life. And you're going to seek learning. Learning, understanding, wisdom, those are good things. So what in the world is going on in this passage where Jesus says, "The wise, the understanding, I hid from them," or "the Father hid from them"? In my sort of previous career before coming here, I was involved in academics. And I was a good student, and I loved learning, and I enjoyed teaching. But there were people who were so much smarter than me and so much more educated than me. I struggled to meet kind of the minimum requirements for foreign languages. And there were people who read 6, 7, 8 languages. There were people who could open up the Bible in Greek and just read it in Greek. not work through it with, you know, a stack of books and a shelf of tools and computer help. No, just read it in Greek. And then flip to the Old Testament and just read it in Hebrew. And read many languages besides. And they were so knowledgeable. And some of them loved Jesus Christ so much. But I knew other people who were great scholars, and even great scholars about Christianity, who nevertheless had never given their lives to Christ. I even knew people who had spent their lives teaching about religion at secular colleges, but teaching in the departments of religious studies, spent their entire lives, year after year, teaching class after class about things like the history of religion in America, or what Christians believe, to college audiences, and yet themselves never could decide if it was true or not. They were waiting for more information. They just need to study a little bit more. They stayed on the fence their entire lives, not making a commitment, not following Jesus Christ. And if you talk to them about Jesus, they had so much information they could defend themselves with. Let me ask you 50 questions that you've never thought of. And after you answer those 50 questions, I can ask you 50 more so that I never have to make a commitment. I can always keep putting off the decision. There are people who are not in academics who do exactly the same thing or a different version of the same thing. They know a lot about Christianity. They know a lot about religion, but they are not themselves followers of Jesus Christ. And knowledge and understanding becomes a way of defending your heart from actually making a commitment to Jesus. We're told to seek knowledge. We're told to seek wisdom. We're told to learn and grow. But to never let that be an arrogance, where we start to look around at other people and say, well, I know more than this person and that person. Look at that person over there crying in the church service. Isn't that silly? I'm much more sophisticated than that. And this person over there is explaining their faith, but, I mean, really, I could explain it better if I wanted to. And I know so much that I can just sort of sit back and be pleased with how much I know. Because I'm comparing myself to other people, and we always, well, often, compare ourselves to other people in ways that put us in the best light and them in the worst light. When you compare your best to somebody else's worst, it's pretty easy to feel good about yourself, right? I know some of us have the other tendency where we compare the worst of ourselves to best of others, and we just feel bad about that as well. But when it comes to faith, we're not asked to compare ourselves to other people. We're asked to compare ourselves to God. If you think of yourself as someone who's wise, if you think of yourself as someone who's understanding, who's knowledgeable, who's very smart or very knowledgeable, or you really have stuff figured out, your basis of comparison needs to be God himself. Come to God, and do you still feel full of yourself? Frankly, there are people who do. This is sad, but they sort of act, they might not put into words, but they act as if they're kind of coming to God on a peer relationship. God, I'll do this for you if you do that for me. Here's the deal. I'm willing to give this to you, and in return, I expect that. I'm willing to be involved in the church, but here's the limitations of what I'm willing to do. And from that, I expect this and this and this. And often you see that blow up in horrible ways. Right? They think they have a contract with God that they've negotiated, and God doesn't live up to the contract. I thought if I was a good person and I went to church and I gave money, the right amount of money, and da-da-da-da, I thought if I did all those things in the contract that I wouldn't get sick, that my spouse wouldn't die before me, that my finances would work out, that my business would prosper, that this and this and this would be the benefits of my contract with God. But God doesn't make a contract with us. He doesn't. And we don't come to him across a negotiating table. We don't sit down as two interested parties and hammer out what I'm willing to do for you and you're willing to do for me. And we don't come to God with wisdom and understanding. We come to God for wisdom and understanding. We don't come to him with wisdom and understanding. We come to God on our knees. Always. Always. We come to God knowing that he knows and we don't. He understands and we don't. He is all wise, all powerful, all knowing, and we are just struggling. And so we come to him on our knees. That's why in the church service we have many opportunities to kneel. And you do not have to worry about kneeling when everybody else kneels. You can kneel whenever you want. There's just some times that are more appropriate than others. And many in our church physically can't really kneel. That's okay. Physically kneeling is just a tool to help your heart kneel. If you can't physically kneel when other people are kneeling, that is okay. Just try in your heart to come to a place of kneeling before God spiritually, of being humble, of saying, I come to you in need and reverence, not in arrogance and demanding. Do your best to kneel with your heart, whether you can kneel physically or not. Because this passage is primarily about a group of people who rejected Jesus Christ when he showed up in the flesh because they thought they had religion figured out and he didn't match what they thought they knew. But it is still applicable to us. And not even just people out there in the world who have rejected Jesus because they think they know too much, because they think they're too smart for him. But it can even be true for us as Christians that sometimes we do not listen to God and we do not kneel before him because we think we've got too much figured out. Sadly, I have seen too many Christian families who can talk about religion and share so much about Christianity, and yet they're not actually living out the faith. They are missing the truths of this in so many stunning ways. I was thinking about this passage and how one of the key truths of this passage is we all come to Jesus Christ as sinners. All of us have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God, as it says elsewhere in the Bible. And so we need to come to him on our knees. But I've heard people use that truth to say, well, we're all sinners. So the fact that I'm sinning and continuing to sin, you can't really talk to me about that because you're a sinner too. So you don't judge me and I won't judge you, and we'll just go on with our sins. That's the very opposite of what this is saying. What this is saying is come to Jesus on your knees because you're a sinner. Be humble before the Lord because you're a sinner, because I'm a sinner. And my sin should break my heart and make me call out to God for help and want to change and want to grow and be humble enough to ask for help. Pastorally, I've talked to so many people who recognize something wrong in their life and then they don't want to do anything about it because they think, people will look down on me and I'll be so ashamed, and if I ask for help, everybody's going to know what's going on and I'll look bad, and so I'm just going to keep struggling on my own. I'm not going to get better. I'm not going to heal. I'm not going to get this sin out of my life or out of my family's life. And they see it devastating themselves and other people because they won't ask for help, because they don't want to be ashamed. They don't want to look like one of the messy people, one of the broken people, one of the bad people. But the truth is, we all come to God as messy and broken and bad people who need his help. And it's incredible that when we came to God as messy and broken and messed up people, he loved us and forgave us. And he continues to forgive us. And by his grace, we get a little less messy and a little less broken and a little less bad day by day by day. And we always keep coming to him because the more he cleans up one part of our life, the more we discover another problem. I don't know if you've ever had a house that got messier and messier and messier, and you just kind of got behind on the cleaning. And so you spent a day cleaning up, and it got a lot better. And you were so proud of how much progress you made. And you woke up the next day and you noticed all these things that were messy or dirty that you didn't notice the first time. Right? Had a sink full of dishes. Oh, I got those dishes put away. And then I noticed there's papers all over the counter or whatever. Our lives are like that. There is so much sin and mess in our lives that when God starts to address it, he usually only shows us a few things, hopefully, because we couldn't handle everything that was wrong with us. And by God's grace, he works in our lives to fix big problems. And then we start to discover other things. I thought my problem was anger, and it was, and I stopped being an angry person. And then I found out, you know what, there's a lot of pride in my life too. Or there's a lot of greed, or there's a lot of whatever else. We discover new areas of our life. And if we're constantly coming to Jesus on our knees and saying, you love me as a broken, messy person that needs work, then when he confronts us with a new place that we need help, that we need growth, that we need fixing by him, that we need his help and his grace, instead of feeling shame, or at least instead of staying in shame, it becomes a gift. Because if you're a person who's angry all the time, you are wrecking the relationships in your life. And when that anger goes away, all of your relationships get so much better. If you're a proud person, you are destroying relationships in your life. And when that pride is replaced with humility, you find yourself such a loving person, so much richer in your relationships. When you stop being filled with greed, you become content and grateful. If you're a greedy person, it doesn't matter how much you have. You're always going to need more to be happy. When the greed goes away, you become content with what you have, and everything you receive becomes a blessing that you're thankful for. When God shows us areas of sin in our life, it's an opportunity for him to transform our lives in ways that are going to make us so much happier. Not that happiness is the most important thing, but it's a wonderful benefit. When God fixes our lives, it's so good for us. We come on his knees, and here's the other part of the passage that's so shocking. He talks about putting a yoke on us. This is an image that developed over time in ancient literature and in the scriptures. The yoke actually originally referred to scales, like you would measure things on, right? The scales that tip one way or the other. And then they use that same word or image to talk about the yoke that they would put on animals, right? That's probably how we most often think about it, putting it on oxen and things like that, and they pull the plow because they have the yoke on their shoulders. And then it actually became applied also to people. Servants would have a yoke. A poor person who is doing manual labor might have a yoke, something on their shoulders, and they would lug stuff for a rich person. They would carry stuff. A slave might have a yoke, and they would carry stuff. And the closest thing we have to that would be someone with a giant backpack on, right? But I'm not talking about when you're going hiking. I'm talking more about, you know, if those of you that were in the military, maybe when you were in basic training, you had to go on long hikes with a big, heavy pack. It's more like that. To haul things. It's not a nice image. It's the image, again, of a slave or of an incredibly poor person who has no job skills. And the only way they can make money, the only way they can support themselves, is to literally just use the strength of their body to do the same things that animals do. That should be shocking to us. The image that we would be like that for God. Can you see yourself as someone who would offer yourself to God for whatever he would use you for, even if that was pure animal work, at least metaphorically? But when we submit ourselves to God, when we say, God, you are my master, you are my Lord, I will do whatever you want me to do, Jesus in turn says, you will find that yoke. You will find the burden that I put on your back to be rest. My burden will be rest for your souls. That's an incredible idea. What would it be like to be unemployed for years and to find yourself tired every day, worn out every day, even though you're not working, to feel like your life is devoid of meaning? Not that everyone who's unemployed feels that way, but just imagine it. To feel as if your life was devoid of meaning and you woke up every day and felt so weary. And then you got hired for a job and you had all these doubts. You thought, I'm going to start this job, but I haven't been working for so long. It's going to be so hard. Am I going to make it through a single day of work, much less a week of work? And then you go to the job and you work all day long and you come home with more energy than when you left, with a sense of fulfillment, with a sense of life is good and meaningful and I feel great. That happens. Not to everyone, not all the time, but that does happen. when you do work that's a pleasure and it feels meaningful and it feels like I am doing work that matters and I feel good about it and I feel energized, not drained. That is what following Jesus Christ is like. He puts a burden on our backs, but that burden actually leaves us feeling more rested than not. I just talked about giving up sin in our lives and how wonderful it is as a blessing, how happy that can make us. That's part of the burden. Give up greed. Give up pride. Give up anger. That's a burden that actually frees us. It's like giving up a burden of debt. Right? God puts a burden on you and says you can't be in debt anymore. And suddenly you're living debt-free. That's a burden that frees you. Give up the sin that's involved in your life and you'll feel so much freer. Take on the burden of spending time with God every day. It can feel like a burden. We feel so full in our lives and so busy. So many of you who are retired have told me that nevertheless you feel busy. Where am I even going to find the time to pray every day? Where am I going to find the time to read the Bible every day? I don't have the time for it. And then you say, but I think the Lord wants me to. I'm going to make time. And you find as you do that, you feel like you have more time. I do that. I have in my calendar times blocked out for morning prayer and often come to work intending to do morning prayer first thing in the morning. And then I'll make the mistake of checking my email first. And 2 hours go by and I never got to morning prayer. And I feel like I wasted all this time. And the next day I go in and I pray first. I do morning prayer first. I read the Bible first. And I reach 10 o'clock and I feel like I've had such a productive day. I don't mean that I'm praying for 2 hours, I understand. I mean I pray for 20 or 30 minutes of the combination of prayer and reading the Bible and praying for other people and all that. And suddenly the next hours are so much more productive. And I don't mean that as some promise where if you pray, God will suddenly, you know, give you more energy or God will automatically make you more successful. It's not like that. It's not a contract again. It's that when we live right, our lives go better in general. When you make time for the most important thing, you actually have more time. You may have noticed that with your family, right? When you make time to spend with your family, things go better. If you started saying, I'm never going to have dinner with my family because we just don't have time to all sit down together for a meal, you find that that doesn't really free up your time. It's not like you have all this extra time. It's just that you spend less time with your family. And the things that matter most get lost. I understand, by the way, that there are all kinds of particular circumstances, and it might be easier for you to have breakfast together as a family than dinner or whatever. Do whatever you need to. I just mean, if you make time for the things that matter most, everything else kind of falls into place. But when you let yourself get lost in other burdens, burdens that are not from the Lord, everything else gets harder. Receive the burden of the Lord. Come to Him on your knees. Let Him set the priorities. And things fall into place. Slowly, but they do. Trust in the Lord. Come before Him and believe Him when He tells you that His yoke is easy. His burden is light. And if you let Him burden you, you will find rest for your souls. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen.